En route.
14. Ryan was back inside the Hotel de Serre. The five terrorists had spoken to the manager, and now they were being led through an employee access door. Ryan passed close to them as he headed for the main stairwell. He took the stairs at an even pace until he rounded the first landing and was shielded from the lobby. Then he began sprinting to the third floor, which was, in the European system, four flights of stairs up from ground level. As he climbed, he spoke into his headset.
John, you want me to call the local cops?
Clark's voice came right back. He sounded like he was in the lobby of the Four Seasons now.
There won't be time to get a SWAT team together, which means the first few beat cops that make the scene are going to get slaughtered, as well as any passers-by if the fight dumps out into the lobby.
Right, Ryan said as he passed the second floor in a sprint, heading to the third. Ryan pulled his Glock from the waistband under his jacket as he arrived at the third floor. He screwed the silencer on the end of the barrel of his pistol and then cracked open the door from the stairwell to the hallway. The hall was dimly lit and narrower than he'd expected. He took a full step out to check the room number closest to him. 312.
Shit.
He whispered.
I have eyes on the hallway. The service elevator is directly ahead about 100 feet. DCRI's room is all the way down the hall by the elevator. No sign of them. I'm going to alert DCRI.
Negative, Ryan, said Clark. You get caught out in that hallway and you're dead.
I'll make it quick.
Listen to me, Jack. You are not to engage Al-Qahtani and his men. Stay right where you are.
Ryan did not reply.
Ryan, confirm my last transmission.
John, DCRI doesn't carry weapons. I'm not going to just let Al-Qahtani kill everyone in that room.
Now Caruso's voice came over the net. From the sound of it, he was down on the sidewalk and walking quickly. He kept his voice low.
Listen to Clark, cuz. Five against one is not going to end well for you. Your Glock is going to feel like a squirt gun if those fucks come out of the elevator with assault rifles. Just stay in the stairwell and wait for the cavalry.
But in the stairwell, Ryan's nostrils flared as he readied himself for action. He couldn't just stand there and watch a massacre unfold before him. The elevator chime clanged at the far end of the hall. Inside room 301, six officers of the Direction Centrale du Renseignement Intérieur were positioned in two teams. Three men lounged on the two beds, reading the morning paper, drinking coffee, and smoking cigarettes. And three more stood or sat around a desk that had been moved in front of the open balcony doors, though it was back from the balcony a dozen feet or so. On the desk were two laptop computers and a laser 3000 microphone listening device mounted on a tabletop tripod. The semiconductor laser beam that emitted from the box-like mechanism shot through a small opening in the sliding glass doors of the balcony, beamed across the open space between the two hotels, reflected off a panorama window of the corner suite at the Four Seasons next door, and then returned to the DCRI room at the Hotel de Serre. Here, the ray was projected onto a receiver on the Laser 3000, and this interpreted the fluctuations in the beam caused by vibrations on the window and translated these fluctuations into recognizable speech. This wasn't a perfect surveillance operation by any stretch of the imagination. Since the curtains were closed on Omar 8's window, they could not see into the suite, and they could pick up only faint voices intermittently. But the device did confirm that Omar 8 and his associates were still in there, and that was important. As soon as they left, one of the three-man DCRI teams would head over to the Four Seasons and plant several more effective bugs while the other monitored from this overwatch position. In the meantime, they all drank coffee and smoked and complained about the American government. A few years ago, they would have received support for an op like this from the CIA. Omar 8 was allegedly URC. The United States was undeniably interested in URC operators, especially when they were moving through Western capitals with fighting-aged associates and 100 pounds or so of baggage. Sure, the URC had made many threats against the French, one just the week before. But they had never attacked France, whereas they had attacked the United States multiple times, killing hundreds there and abroad. The damn American consulate was just a mile away. Why weren't les Américains here right now, providing intelligence and equipment and manpower for this operation?
Les Américains, mumbled the DCRI detail as they monitored the corner suite next door.
They all agreed they certainly weren't what they used to be. The elevator door slid open on the third floor of the Hotel de Serre. 100 feet away, concealed by much of the stairwell door and dim lights behind him,
Jack Ryan Jr. leveled his suppressed Glock at the movement. A single housekeeper pushed a rolling cart full of towels and trash bins out of the service elevator and onto the floor. There was no one behind her. Jack lowered the pistol before she saw it, or even him, and he quietly shut the staircase door until only the tip of his shoe held it open. He breathed a muted sigh of relief. The housekeeper had delayed the arrival of the terrorists, but only by a minute or so. They would be here soon enough. She and her cart continued up the hallway slowly, completely oblivious to any danger. Just then, the sound of running up the stairs below Ryan caused him to turn. Before he had time to do much more than register that he was hearing the footfalls of two men, Chavez transmitted on the net.
"We're coming to you, Ryan. Hold fire."
"Roger." Clark transmitted next. "Ding, I'm in the main elevator. ETA 60 seconds. Can you and Dom make entry on 301's balcony via 401? Chavez and Dom ran past Ryan at a full sprint, their faces distorted and unrecognizable due to their rubber masks. Chavez spoke as he climbed.
"I like it. We'll do a rush job version of what we'd planned next door."
"You're gonna have to make it quick," Ryan said. Clark replied, "Ryan, I need you down in the lobby." Jack couldn't believe what he was hearing.
"What?"
"You have to be ready to get the van and bring it around. Sam doesn't have the keys, you do. We can't wait around when this is over. Plus, we have a tango still on the street. If he comes in, I want you ready to stop him."
Ryan started to protest. He had to whisper because the maid was only a few feet away. She opened the door to her room after knocking and disappeared inside.
"John, you've got to be kidding. I've got eyes on the hall. I can cover..."
"Ryan, I'm not going to argue with you. Go down to the lobby."
"Yes, sir," Jack said, and he spun away from the door and began heading down the stairs.
God damn it.
Ding Chavez got slightly ahead of Dominic as they sprinted up the fourth floor hallway. Both men doffed their rain parkas and let them fall as they ran on, got their hands on their subguns, and unslung the ropes from their necks. When he arrived at the door to room 401, Chavez just shouldered right through it, smashing the bolt out of the door jamb and sending the door flying in. He fell to the ground and Caruso leapt over him with his HK trained toward movement on the bed. A middle-aged couple were eating their room service breakfast on their bed and watching television.
"Well, the bloody hell!"
shouted the man in a thick English accent. The woman screamed. Caruso ignored the couple. Instead, he just ran toward the balcony and slid the door open. Chavez was back with him now. Together, they hurriedly dropped their ropes, took the metal carabiners fixed to one end of them, and then hooked the carabiners on the heavy iron railing of the balcony. Right then, Clark transmitted in a whisper. His voice sounded pleasant and happy, and he spoke in a British accent.
"Got a late a bit heading up, darling. I'll be there in half a minute. Feel free to stop breakfast without me."
The men on the balcony knew they were on their own. Clark was still in the elevator, obviously surrounded by civilians. They had no time to wait on him. Dom and Domingo climbed over the fourth floor railing, holding onto their HK subguns with one hand and their ropes with the other. They turned to face the hotel room and noticed the English couple had already hustled out the front door, no doubt terrorized by what they had just witnessed. With a quick look between them and a nod from Chavez, both he and Dom leaned back, away from the railing of the balcony. 5 stories down was the Avenue Pierre Le Desabie. Traffic rolled by without a care. The two Americans high above the traffic pushed off with their legs. They spent just over a second in the air before swinging down to the balcony below. Directly in front of them now, behind the glare of the sun's reflection on balcony doors that were just slightly cracked open, they could see 3 of the 6 DCRI men in the room. One stood right on the other side of the glass, 6 feet from the Americans' noses. In his hand was a cup of coffee and a cigarette. 2 more sat behind a table in the center of the room. Ahead and to the left of Chavez and Caruso were the bed and bathroom, wide of the balcony. And behind the desk with the surveillance equipment was a narrow entryway in front of the door. Needless to say, the 3 Frenchmen reacted with shock to the armed men rappelling onto their balcony. Even more so when the 2 men released their ropes and brought the short buttstocks of their weapons to their shoulders. Caruso and Chavez each took a step forward into a half-crouch firing stance. Chavez screamed,
"Dégagez! Move!"
Just as, directly behind the wide-eyed Frenchman, the door to their room flew open behind the shoulder of one of the Middle Eastern assassins. 15. John Clark had been forced to physically push 2 Chinese businessmen out of the elevator on the 2nd floor. They had ignored him when he asked them to take another car. They had yelled back at him angrily when he demanded they get out. And even when he resorted to pulling his pistol on them,
They just stared at it in confusion. Finally, he shoved them out and pushed the closed door button before continuing on up alone. Now he was arriving at the third floor. His SIG pistol was out and ready, the silencer in place. He knew Al-Qahtani and his men would be in the hall by now, if they were not already in room 301. And he also knew his own arrival on the floor would be announced in advance with a ringing bell and a flash of light above the elevator doors. Not exactly a covert dynamic entry. When the doors opened, he leaned out and to the right with his pistol at eye level. Immediately, he ducked back into the elevator. No sooner had he pulled his head out of the hallway when unsuppressed, fully automatic machine pistol fire tore into his elevator car. He flattened himself on the floor, then reached up with the tip of his silencer and pressed the door hold button, locking open the doors here in range of the enemies. He'd seen the gunmen right as they kicked at the door to 301. They were carrying Scorpion machine pistols, a small weapon that fired a .32 caliber bullet at a rate of 850 rounds per minute. Only one man was looking back in Clark's direction, but that tango had been ready to gun down whoever the hell exited the elevator. John had felt the overpressure of the supersonic rounds and they missed his face by inches, and now he was effectively pinned down inside the elevator. Another burst of fire tore through the aluminum car as he pressed his face flat on the cold floor, the sound in the hallway like the ripping of paper into a microphone attached to the amp stacks of a heavy metal band. Al-Qahtani and his men fired first. Ding heard the sound of automatic weapons fire just as he got his finger to the trigger of his HK. The Frenchman in the hotel room reacted surprisingly quickly. The two men at the desk dove for the floor, and the man standing with the coffee and cigarettes spun away from the gunman on the balcony and ducked upon hearing the door smash and the gunfire behind him. Ding got a snapshot picture on an armed tango in the doorway and squeezed off a double tap through the glass of the sliding balcony doors, hitting the chest of the first terrorist. The man spun 180 degrees. His scorpion flew from his hands, whipped by the sling around his neck as he landed on his back. The glass of the balcony door shattered with the impacts. Dominic Caruso fired a pair of double taps at the threats across the room, then kicked a remaining crotch-high glass shard free from the doorframe as he stepped through it. The second terrorist through the door had sighted his machine pistol on the first DCRI operative, but Dom took him out with a double tap to the forehead. The man's skull exploded. Blood drenched the wall of the entryway. Both Dom and Ding had entered the room now. The third assassin dove to the floor of the hallway, using the slumped bodies of his two dead compatriots for cover. The Frenchmen in the bedroom scrambled to get themselves out of the line of fire. They dove to the floor next to the bed or crawled into the bathroom. Not one of them had a firm grasp on what was happening right in front of them, but the two men who'd rappelled to the balcony had made it clear with their shouts and actions that they were there to help. A long, uncontrolled spray by the third gunman at the door emptied his scorpion. He rolled onto his side to reload it, and his partners in the hall covered for him by firing into the room indiscriminately. Both Dom and Ding had advanced farther into the room to get out of the line of fire. Chavez shepherded the six Frenchmen into the bathroom. One of the men had been shot through the hand. With the bathroom door shut, Caruso lay on the floor in front of the bed, rolled out onto his right shoulder to get a narrow field of fire on the tangos. He fired short, controlled bursts from his HK, hitting one of the men in the hallway in both legs, dropping him into the entryway. Dom then shot the wounded man in the face with his last bullet. "Reloading!" he shouted to Chavez. Ding stepped over him, leaned around the corner toward the entryway, and fired 4.6mm rounds at the opposing force. Three of his bullets tore through the face and throat of the terrorist on the floor of the entryway, sending the man tumbling backward and causing arterial blood to jet into the air like a sprinkler. There was one more tango, but he was out in the hall. Chavez couldn't hit him unless the man stuck his head back into the doorway. Dom had reloaded, and he covered the entryway while Chavez took a moment to put a fresh magazine into the grip of his weapon. As Chavez worked his HK's action to chamber another round, he spoke into his headset. "There's one out there with you, John." "John?" John Clark did not answer Chavez, careful not to make a sound as he peered around the open door of the elevator car. He looked down the hallway toward the source of all the gunfire. Still in a low crouch, he held his Sig Sauer pistol at the end of his extended arms at eye level. Other than two dead bodies half in and half out of room 301, the hallway was empty. Where the fuck did the last guy go? The door to the suite immediately on Clark's right opened, and an Asian man peered out. Clark swiveled his weapon toward the movement, but he recognized quickly this was no threat. He took his left hand off his pistol to motion for the guest to go back inside and shut the door,
and the Asian man was all too happy to comply with his request. But when John turned his attention back to the hall in front of him, he did see movement, and it came from a doorway on the left, on the opposite side, and just closer than the DCRI's room. The door was open, and a blonde-haired woman stepped out slowly. The forearm of a man was wrapped tightly around her neck. She came all the way into the hallway now, and she was not alone. Holding her from behind was Abdul bin Muhammad al-Qahtani, operational commander of the Umayyad Revolutionary Council. He held a black scorpion machine pistol in his right hand, and the tip of his barrel was pressed tight under the woman's chin. The lady was in her 50s. Clark guessed she might have been Swedish, but he had no way to know for sure. She sobbed, and mascara dripped down her cheeks as she slammed her eyes shut. Clark stepped out into the hallway fully now, keeping his weapon pointed at the threat ahead of him and his eyes on his target through his notch and post sights. Calmly, he spoke softly into his earpiece microphone.
"Stay in the room and get ready to leave. I'll be right there."
"Roger that," said Dominic. The blonde woman's eyes opened now. Black tears drained down her cheeks. She blinked away the wetness and saw the armed man in the hallway 20 feet ahead. Her eyes went wide and her pink face reddened even more. For his part, al-Qahtani looked a little more relaxed than his hostage, but not much. He shouted in Arabic,
"Stay back or I will kill her!"
He took a single step backward, pulling the blonde with him.
"Of course," replied Clark in Arabic, surprising al-Qahtani by speaking his native tongue. "I will stay back. What do you want?"
The Arab did not answer. He just stared at the figure with a distorted face in amazement. Who was this man? How did he get here? Was he with the others, the ones who just killed all his men and thwarted his operation?
"I'm listening," Clark said calmly. "I am listening to you, friend. Just tell me your demands, and please do not hurt the woman."
He kept the weapon trained on the URC commander while he spoke. Al-Qahtani recovered a little more as he realized he retained some control over this situation. He pulled the blonde tighter to him with his forearm. By this action, he literally pinned their faces together, cheek to cheek. He kept the machine pistol pressed tight under her chin. He did not know who this man was, but he spoke as if his main concern was the safety of the woman. Al-Qahtani screamed,
"I want everyone back! Out of my way!"
He began pulling the blonde backward to the service elevator, the friction of the carpet against her high heels ripping the shoes from her feet.
"I want all the police to leave the hotel, and the stairwell cleared, and the car brought to the entrance."
Clark nodded but kept his weapon steady.
"Of course, of course. This is no problem. Just don't hurt her. There is no need. I will get a car for you. But where will the car take you? Do you need a helicopter or a plane?
We can arrange for you to go to the airport or the train station, or if you like, you can go to..." John Clark pressed the soft trigger of his SIG 220 and shot Abdul bin Muhammad al-Qahtani through the right eye orbit, severing the man's medulla oblongata and knocking him backward into the service elevator. The body hit the cold metal floor even before Clark's .45 caliber shell casing landed on the carpet of the hallway. The scorpion machine pistol clanged off the wall and landed at al-Qahtani's feet. The woman looked at Clark for a long moment before putting her hand out to the wall next to her. She took a single, slow step forward. Clark lowered his pistol, hurried to her, and caught her under her arms as she fainted. He lowered her onto the carpet gently, and then turned to run back to room 301. During all the action above, Jack Ryan had stood on the landing between the ground floor and the first floor. Below him, he could see a portion of the lobby, but he remained concealed from the hotel employees by the reception counter. When the shooting started, people ran past him on their way down from the guest floors above. Some were screaming, some were calm, but all were hustling down to the lobby or even out into the street. Ryan just stood there on the landing, his hands empty. He'd been listening to the few transmissions from his three teammates above him, and from this he had an understanding of what was going on. He had worked out that they had eliminated all the threats. He assumed Clark would send him to get the minivan with his next transmission. But the next transmission did not come from Clark. It came from Driscoll.
"Sam for Ryan. You copy me?"
"Ryan copies. I'm at the van."
"Okay, I'll come out." "Listen up. The black Mercedes truck just pulled up at the corner. The driver is heading inside like he's got some place to be."
Quickly, Jack turned around toward the lobby. The stairwell was clear now. There were no more stragglers heading down past him. He backed up the stairs to the first floor and then trained his eyes on the landing turn from where he had just come. He pulled his Glock and shielded it between his right hip and the wall. Clark's voice came over the net now. Jack, that target is yours.
Understood. He prepared for the man to appear on the staircase, but then a thought entered his amped-up brain. What if the guy ran straight into the guest elevator in the lobby? Or into the employee area where he could take the employee elevator? Shit. Jack would miss him, and the tango would hit the team upstairs and catch them unprepared.
Jack began running down the stairs. He had to get eyes on the lobby so he could determine where the...
A large bearded man appeared from the lobby, running up the staircase hard and fast, and he crashed into Ryan. Both men lost their balance and tumbled. As Jack fell, he felt his ribs brush against the grip of a pistol in the bearded man's hand, just as Ryan's own handgun slipped out of his fingertips. Together, the two men rolled out into the lobby. Ryan recognized the other man as the driver of Al-Qahtani's Mercedes truck. The terrorist ended his fall on top of Jack, and he reached back to hit the American in the face, but Ryan shoved the palm of his hand hard into the bearded man's chin and then flipped him off him to the marble floor. Ryan started to go for his gun. He could see where it skidded after hitting the lobby floor, but instead Al-Qahtani's driver rolled quickly to his knees and then charged from a three-point stance. Ryan could not get out of the way of the attack, so he dropped backward toward the floor, reached out and grabbed the man's jacket, and spun him back to the ground. The big man crashed to the ground, but he rolled up to his knees quickly, then turned and charged Ryan again. This time Jack leapt to his feet, sidestepped the attack, and slammed the palm of his right hand into the driver's head as he stumbled past him. The URC terrorist fell to the floor, dazed by the blow to his skull. Jack had the advantage now, and he leapt on the man, grabbed him by the hair, and slammed his head viciously into the marble tile floor. Once, twice, and then a third time, when there was no resistance from the neck muscles of the terrorist, and the skull cracked audibly, echoing in the empty lobby. Ryan hesitated for just a moment, tried to catch his breath, then he gave up. Still on the verge of hyperventilation, he climbed off the dead terrorist and grabbed his pistol from the floor. He holstered it and then reached up to check for his earpiece. Miraculously, it was still in place in his ear.
This is Ryan. Tango down.
Copy that. You okay? It was Clark.
Ryan nodded to himself, held his breath for a second to catch his wind, and then said,
I'm bringing the van around. 2 minutes.
Ryan crossed the wide floor, heading for the exit, but he was met by uniformed prefect police, who poured through the doors with pistols in their hands. Jack stepped to the side, held his hands up, and then, feigning panic, he crouched like a terrified tourist. Outside in the street by the black Mercedes truck, he saw several police cars. The vehicles were empty. Their occupants had just passed him on their way to the stairs. After the police ran past him through the lobby, Ryan hurried out the door and spoke into his headset.
Guys, listen up. 8 cops heading up the main stairwell. You're going to have to find another exit.
Okay, it was Clark's voice now. I'm with Ding and Dom. We'll come up with something. Be ready to pick us up.
16. 90 seconds later, Domingo Chavez fired bursts from his Heckler & Koch MP7 through the hinges of a locked metal door to the roof of the hotel. The three men stepped out into a bright sky, as all around them the sounds of sirens echoed off the buildings. They found themselves on a flat roof here, but in order to move away from the entrance to the hotel, they were forced to head to the northwest, crossing 2 large early modern-style apartment buildings. Here the roofs of the adjacent buildings were steep, with glazed brick masonry. The roofs were all of different heights and gradients, with only a few narrow walkways. The next building over was a full story taller than the one they were on, so they were forced to climb up narrow masonry steps to begin their escape from the police. And the police were close behind. Chavez led the way, and he directed Dom and John to pull on their black ski masks. There was no sense now in even maintaining the semi-covert facial distortion masks, so they might as well attempt to hide even the color of their skin. As they ran, climbed, and skittered 5 and 6 floors above the streets of Paris, they heard shouting on the roof behind them at the Hotel Dessert. From the tone of the yelling, they knew they'd been spotted. Clark called back over his shoulder to Caruso.
Toss smoke to cover us.
Dom reached into the messenger bag on his back, pulled a smoke grenade, and yanked the pin from it. Bright red smoke spewed from one end, and Dom laid it down next to the vertical glass side of a sawtooth roof. He ran on. The smoke cloud fattened in the breeze on the roof, and it obstructed the Americans' retreat. After sliding on their backsides down the steep side of a mansard roof that ended at a partition to the next building,
They climbed over the low wall and found themselves looking down 5 stories into a beautiful garden courtyard surrounded by a stony Art Nouveau building full of luxury office space. Faces in the windows of the offices stared at the armed men in the ski masks. Some turned quickly and ran away. Others just looked on, wide-eyed, as if they were watching a police drama on television. Chavez, Clark, and Caruso continued on to the northwest. Within another 30 seconds, they began to hear the persistent thump of a helicopter. They did not bother to stop and look for it. Whether it was a police helo or television station's traffic copter, it did not matter. They had to get off the roof. Finally, they skittered to the end of the flat part of a 2-angled mansard roof. Beyond that, they found themselves looking down, 5 stories down, onto the Rue Quentin Bouchard, a 2-lane street that signified the end of the block. There was no obvious way down, no well-anchored drain pipe, no easy way to descend the architectural flourish on the facade. Only a large bay window 10 feet below them that jutted out of the steeply angled roof. They were trapped. The shouts from behind grew in volume. The 3 men knelt on the edge of the roof. The squawking of sirens back on the Avenue Georges V was unreal. There had to have been 50 emergency vehicles in the area now. There didn't seem to be a police presence directly below them on the street, yet, anyway, as the Rue Quentin Bouchard was not really the back of the hotel itself. Rather, the Americans had managed to reach this position only by clawing their way over partitions between buildings and along small access walls that connected the buildings of the block together. Still, with so many vehicles and men, it certainly would not take the French police much more time to branch out at ground level as well, and once that happened, this street would be locked down by the authorities.
"What's below us, Ding?" John asked, as Chavez had the best look over the edge.
"Looks residential. Could be civilians under the roof, there's no way to know."
Caruso and Clark knew what he meant. They did have small explosives in Dom's bag. They could blow a hole in the roof and climb down into the building, then use the stairs to get out. But they wouldn't blow the roof without knowing for certain that there wasn't an occupied apartment, a daycare, or an old folks' home directly below them. And there was only one way they could find out. Dom stood quickly.
"I've got it. John, get back behind that chimney."
Caruso took his HK from around his neck and unfastened the ballistic nylon sling attached to it. He took a moment to pull on the sling to bring it to its full length, and he wrapped his right hand several times around one end. Then he gave the other end to Ding. Chavez took a firm hold, then grabbed the iron railing with his other hand. Clark moved back, and when Ding knelt down at the edge of the roof, Dom Caruso climbed over the side, slid down the steep roof, his shoes scuffing the masonry as Chavez lowered him. He did get just low enough to make it to the bay window. As he hung from his sling, the men still on the roof heard a cracking of window glass as Caruso used his rifle to shatter the pane. Ding struggled with the sling. It dug into his hand and wrist and forearm, but he held tight. After a few more crashes, he felt the sling move hard to the left, and then, suddenly, the weight left the strap. Caruso was in the apartment below them. This was progress, but it didn't really help Clark or Chavez as far as they were concerned. Caruso had not taken time to explain what he was doing, and this confused the 2 men on the roof for a moment. But within 10 seconds of his disappearance from the side of the building, the campus operators on the roof heard Dom in their earpieces.
"Okay, I'm in the attic. It's empty. Gonna use these charges to make you guys a whole. Ding, get over there with John, and both of you keep your heads down."
Clark nodded appreciatively even as he looked back over his shoulder. He heard voices on the roof. The police had made their way through the smoke and were closing fast, likely while following a trail of broken masonry and cracked roofing tiles. They were still on the Art Nouveau building next door, but they would find their way here within a minute. Seconds later, a loud explosion blew smoke, roofing material, and wood into the air on the other side of the brick chimney. While the last of the bits of debris rained back down, Clark and Chavez ran across the roof to the fresh opening and looked in. As soon as the smoke cleared, they saw Caruso pushing a chest of drawers across a wooden attic floor below them. When he had it below the hole, Clark helped Domingo down on top of it. Chavez quickly turned back to help his partner down. A crack from a pistol 50 feet behind Clark caused Chavez to duck instinctively as he took hold of Clark's arm. He felt a jolt go through the other man's body, and John Clark spun around, then fell into the hole in the roof. Chavez and Clark fell off of the chest of drawers and onto Dominic Caruso.
"Shit!"
shouted Chavez.
"Where you hit, John?"
Clark was already struggling to his feet. He winced in pain, raised a forearm to show that his dirty sport coat was covered in blood.
"It's not bad. I'm fine," he said,
But both Caruso and Chavez had been around firearms long enough to recognize Clark was in no position to know how badly he'd been hurt. Even with this, Caruso had the presence of mind to worry about the cops above them on the roof. Quickly, he reached into his backpack and pulled out a flashbang grenade. He pulled the pin and lobbed it out into the direction of the men approaching. He thought it likely that French police officers would not recognize the device, at least not instantly, and they would have to entertain the possibility that they were being fired on by the fleeing gunmen. The Americans needed to buy a few seconds' time to make their way downstairs, and the grenade did just that. It exploded next to the chimney with an ear-splitting boom. Clark led the way out of the attic, down a flight of stairs, and onto a circular staircase that spiraled down to ground level. Chavez spoke tersely into his mic.
"Jack, we're coming out. Ground floor of an apartment building about 100 yards northwest of the Hotel de Serre. 30 seconds."
"Roger that. I'll be there. Sirens approaching from the Avenue Marceau behind me, and George Sank is full of heat."
"Whatever,"
Chavez said as he and his two colleagues rushed down the stairs. That was a problem for 60 seconds from now. He couldn't worry about it just yet. All three Americans flew out of the door of the apartment and onto the street. Jack and Sam were there in the maroon Galaxy with the side door open. The three fell inside just as the first police car skidded around the corner and into the street from behind them. Driscoll helped Clark into a seat and immediately began assessing his bloody arm. Even though the police were 50 yards back, Ryan didn't floor it. He had the presence of mind to drive normally as he headed toward Avenue Georges V. They passed a language school and a restaurant where the waiters were just setting up bistro tables on the pavement for the lunch service. Several men and women on the sidewalk stared at their car as they passed. Perhaps they'd come outside to investigate the origin of the sirens, then heard or saw the ruckus on the roof, and then the men pouring out of the apartment. But so far, no one on the street had raised an alarm. Jack knew he couldn't drive onto Avenue Georges V in front of him. It was crawling with police, and a roadblock had likely already been set up. Instead, he drove slowly toward it, watched his rearview mirror until the police cars behind him began stopping on the street in front of the apartment, and only when he could wait no longer, he jacked the wheel to the left and turned into the one-way traffic pouring off of the Rue Magellan. Certain that at least some of the parked police cars had seen him, he punched the accelerator now as he leaned toward the windshield to take in as much of the road in front of him as possible. The cars on the street shot toward him. He wove left and then right to avoid the oncoming traffic. Within seconds, he made a right on the Rue de Bassano, found himself on a second street traveling in the wrong direction, but he kept going, faster and faster. A last-second reaction to avoid a taxi sent Ryan and the rest of the team up onto the narrow sidewalk. They scraped a pair of parked cars as they shot through passers-by diving into doorways or out into the street to avoid the dented minivan. At an intersection, Ryan avoided a group of employees standing in front of their Russian restaurant, and he pulled back onto the street, crashed through a neat line of bicycles for rent, then passed the Louis Vuitton flagship store as he pulled out onto the wide Champs-Élysées. For the first time in a minute and a half, he found himself driving in the same direction as traffic. Also for the first time in several minutes, the men did not hear the shrill squawking of police sirens right behind them. Jack reached up to wipe sweat from his forehead, but his rubber mask got in the way. His hairline was soaked with perspiration, so he slicked back his dark hair to get it out of his face. "Where to now?" Ryan asked the men behind him. Clark's voice was gravel, broadcasting to the vehicle the pain the ex-Navy SEAL was in at the moment, but his voice remained strong.
"Safe house," he said. "We're going to need a new ride. Can't pull into the airport driving the most wanted vehicle in France."
"Roger that," said Ryan, and he punched a button on the GPS that would lead him to the safe house. "How are you feeling?"
"I'm okay," said Clark.
But Sam Driscoll had been checking Clark. He applied pressure to the wound as he leaned forward into the front seat.
"Get there as fast as you can."
Adaris Sherman stood inside the doorway of the Gulfstream with an HKUMP 45 caliber submachine gun held in one hand behind her back. She watched a four-door sedan pull to a stop on the tarmac, saw the five men climb out and approach. Four of them carried backpacks, but John Clark had his arm in a makeshift sling under his blue sport coat. Even from a distance, she could see his face was ashen. Quickly, she'd scanned the airport grounds, determined the coast to be clear, then rushed back inside the aircraft to grab medical supplies. On board, she bandaged Clark quickly, knowing that a customs official would be on his way out to see them off. While she helped him get a clean jacket on, The other men changed into clean suits and ties that had been ready for them in the Gulfstream's coat closet, but only after stowing their clothing and gear in the stash compartment below an inspection panel in the floor. Within minutes, a female customs agent climbed aboard. She opened two of the businessmen's briefcases and glanced inside, and then asked the bearded gentleman if he wouldn't mind opening his suitcase. This he did, but she didn't look past the socks and gym clothes. The older gentleman reclining on the couch in the back was not feeling well, so she did not disturb him other than to see that his face matched the passport handed to her by one of his younger employees. The female customs official finally checked the pilot's paperwork, thanked everyone, and was seen out the door by the flight attendant. The door shut behind her, and within seconds, the aircraft was taxiing out of the yellow customs square on the ramp. Captain Reed and First Officer Hicks had the wheels up in 5 minutes. While they were still on their takeoff climb out of Paris airspace, Sherman had stopped the bleeding from Clark's arm. Before the aircraft reached 10,000 feet, she had an IV line in the top of his hand and an antibiotics drip moving slowly into his bloodstream to stave off any infection. As soon as Country turned off the seatbelt light in the cabin, Chavez rushed back to check on his friend. "How is he?" Chavez asked, a worried tone in his voice. Sherman poured antiseptic into the wound now, examining the holes as the clear liquid cleaned the blood away. "He's lost a fair amount of blood. He needs to lie flat for the flight, but the round went through and through and he's moving his hand okay." She looked up at her patient. "You'll be fine, Mr. Clark." John Clark smiled at her. With a weak voice, he said, "I had a feeling Jerry didn't hire you to pass out peanuts." Sherman laughed. "Naval corpsman, 9 years. "That's a tough job. You were deployed with the Marines?"
4 years in the sandbox. I saw a lot of wounds worse than yours."
"I bet you did," John said with a nod of understanding. Caruso had headed alone up to the galley. He returned, stood over everyone who was kneeling over Clark. In his hand was a crystal highball of Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch. He addressed Sherman.
"What do you think, Doc? Can I give him a dose of this?"
She looked Clark over and nodded. "In my professional opinion, Mr. C looks like he needs a drink." The Gulfstream flew over the English Channel, leaving French airspace just after 11 a.m. at a cruising altitude of 36,000 feet. 17. Even though he looked every second of his 69 years, Nigel Embling was no pushover. At 6 feet 4 inches and 250 pounds, he retained considerable brawn to go with his fertile brain. Still, within 1 second of opening his eyes, he recognized his predicament and raised his hands to indicate he would put up no fight. He'd awoken to guns in his face, flashlight beams in his eyes, and shouts in his ears. Though startled and worried, he did not panic. As a resident of Peshawar, Pakistan, he knew well that he lived in a city rife with crime, terrorism, and government and law enforcement thuggery, so even before he'd forced the cobwebs of sleep out of his mind, he was already wondering which of these three he was waking up to this morning. Clothes were thrown to him, and he struggled out of his nightshirt and into the ensemble offered by the gunman, and then he was shoved to his staircase, down the stairs, and toward the front door. Mahmoud, Embling's young orphaned houseboy, knelt on the floor with his face against the wall. He'd made the mistake of rushing one of the armed men who'd kicked in the front door. For his bravery, Mahmoud received a boot in his chin and a rifle's butt in the back. He was then ordered to kneel and face the wall while Embling was collected from his bedroom and allowed to dress. In Urdu, tinged with a phony Dutch accent, Embling shouted at the young gunners, admonishing them like children for their treatment of the boy. In the next breath, in soothing words, he told Mahmoud to run along to a neighbor's to have his bruises and scrapes seen after, and he promised the terrified boy that there was nothing to be alarmed about and that he would return straight away. Once outside in the dark street, he had a better idea about what was going on. Two black SUVs of the same make and model common with Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate agents sat parked on the curb, and four more plain-clothed men stood in the street carrying big HKG-3 rifles, a standard military-issue weapon of the Pakistani Defense Force. Yes, Embling was certain now. He was being scooped up by the ISI, the National Spy Agency. It wasn't good news by any stretch. He knew enough about their modus operandi to recognize that a pre-dawn rousting at gunpoint likely meant a basement cell and a bit of the rough stuff at the very least. But getting picked up by the Army-run intelligence organization was a damn sight better than being kidnapped by Tehrik-e-Taliban, the Haqqani Network, Al-Qaeda, the URC, Lashkar-e-Omar, the Quetta Shura Taliban, the Nadim Commando, or any one of the other terror outfits running around armed and angry on these dangerous streets of Peshawar. Nigel Embling was a former member of British Foreign Intelligence, and he knew how to talk to other intelligence officers. That he might be forced to do so while getting his knuckles broken or his head dunked in a bucket of cold water hardly appealed to him. But he knew this was preferable to dealing with a room full of jihadists who would just quickly and messily hack his head from his neck with a dull sword. The plain-clothed riflemen on either side of Embling in the back seat of the SUV said nothing as they drove through the empty streets of the city. Embling didn't bother to ask the men any questions. He knew he would have his only opportunity to get answers wherever it was he was going. These men were just the scoop crew. These men had been provided with a name and a picture and an address, and then they'd been sent out on this errand as if they'd been sent down to the corner market for tea and cakes. They would be here for their ability to squeeze triggers and put their boots into backsides. They wouldn't be sent along with the answer to any of Embling's questions. So he kept quiet and concentrated on their route. The ISI's main HQ in Peshawar is just off Khyber Road in Peshawar's western suburbs, which would have required the SUVs to turn left onto Grand Trunk. But instead, they continued on into the northern suburbs. Embling imagined he was being taken to one of the God knows how many off-site branch locations. The ISI kept a number of safe houses, simple residential flats and commercial office space, all over the city, so that they could cause more unofficial mischief than they could during an official visit to the HQ. The senior Brit expat's suspicions were confirmed when they pulled up in front of a darkened office building, and two men with radios on their vests and Uzi submachine guns hanging from their shoulders stepped out from behind the glass door to greet the vehicles. Without a word, some six men walked Nigel Embling across the pavement, through the doorway, and then up a narrow staircase. He was led into a dark room. He fully expected it to be a cold and stark interrogation cell, but when someone flipped on the fluorescent lighting, he saw it to be a well-used small office, complete with a desk and chairs, a desktop computer, a phone, and a wall full of Pakistani military banners, emblems, and even framed photos of cricket players from the Pakistani national team. The armed men put Embling in the chair, unlocked his handcuffs, and then left the room. Embling looked around, surprised to be left alone in this small but not uncomfortable office. Seconds later, a man entered from behind, stepped around Embling's chair, and slid behind the desk. He wore the tan uniform of the Pakistani army, but his green pullover sweater covered any insignia that might have revealed information to the man sitting across from him. All Embling could discern was that the man was in his late 30s, with a short beard and mustache and a ruddy complexion. He wore narrow, frameless glasses that were propped halfway down his angular nose. "My name is Mohammed Al-Darkur. I am a major in the Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate." Nigel opened his mouth to ask the major why he'd been dragged from his bed and driven across town for the introduction, but Al-Darkur spoke again. "And you, Nigel Embling, you are a British spy." Nigel laughed. "Kudos for getting right to the point, even if your information is incorrect. I am Dutch." "True. My mother was from Scotland, which is technically part of the British Empire, although her family preferred to think of themselves as..." "Your mother was from England, from Sussex," Al-Darkur interrupted. "Her name was Sally, and she died in 1988. Your father's name was Harold, and he was from London, and his death predated the death of your mother by 9 years. Embling's bushy eyebrows rose, but he did not speak. "There is no use in lying. We know all about you. At different times in the past, we have had you under surveillance, and we are quite aware of your affiliation with the British Secret Service." Embling composed himself, chuckled again. "You really are doing this all wrong, Major Darkur. I certainly won't tell you how to do your job, but this isn't much of an interrogation. I believe you need to take a few lessons from some of your colleagues. I've sat in a few ISI dungeons in my time here as a guest of your delightful nation. I've been suspected of this or that by your organization since you were in nappies, I'd wager. This is how you do it. First, you're supposed to start with a little deprivation, maybe some cold." "Does this look like an ISI dungeon?" asked Al-Darkur. Embling looked around again. "No. In fact, your overlords might want to send you back for some remedial training.
You can't even get the scary environment down. Doesn't the ISI have decorators who can help you create that perfect claustrophobic modern horror look? Mr. Emling, this is not an interrogation room. This is my office. Nigel looked the man over for several seconds, shook his head slowly. Then you really haven't a clue how to do your job, do you, Major Aldakur? The Pakistani major smiled, as if indulgent of the old man's taunts. You were picked up this morning because another directorate in the ISI has asked that yourself and other suspicious expatriates like you be brought in for interrogation. After interrogation, I am ordered to begin the process of having you expelled from the country. Wow, thought Embling. What the bloody hell is going on? Not just me, all expatriates? Many. Not all, but many. On what grounds would we be given the boot? No grounds whatsoever. Well, I suppose I am to make up something. Embling did not respond. He was still gobsmacked by this information, and more so by the frank way this man was delivering it. Aldakur continued, There are elements in my organization and in the army as a whole who have enacted a secret military intelligence order that is only to be used in times of high internal conflict or war, in order to lessen the risk of foreign spies or agent provocateurs in our country. We are always in times of high internal conflict here. This is nothing new. And we are not at war. Therefore, their legal grounds are shaky. Still, they are getting away with it. Our civilian government is not aware of the scope or the focus paid to this operation, and this gives me great pause. Aldakur hesitated for a long moment. Twice he began to speak, but stopped himself. Finally, he said, This new edict and other things that have been going on in my organization over the last months have given me reason to suspect some of my high-ranking colleagues of planning a coup against our civilian leadership. Embling had no idea why this military officer, a stranger, would be telling him all this, especially if he really did believe him to be a British spy. I hand-selected your case, Mr. Embling. I made sure that my men would pick you up and bring you to me. What on earth for? Because I would like to offer my services to your nation. It is a difficult time in my country, and there are forces in my organization that are making it more difficult. I believe the United Kingdom can help those of us who, shall I say, do not want the type of change that many in the ISI are seeking. Embling looked across the desk at the man for a long time. He then said, If this is legitimate, then I must ask, of all places, why are we doing this here? Aldakur smiled a handsome smile now. He spoke in an attractive, lilting cadence. Mr. Embling, my office is the one environment in this country where I can be absolutely sure no one is listening in on our conversation. It is not that this room is not bugged, of course it is. But it is bugged for my benefit, and I can control the erase function on the recorder. Embling smiled. He loved nothing more than clever practicality. What division do you work for? JIB. I'm sorry, I don't recognize the acronym. Yes, you do, Mr. Embling. I can show you my file on your associations with other members of the ISI in the past. The Brit shrugged. He decided to drop the pretense of ignorance. Joint Intelligence Bureau, he said. Very well. My duties take me into the Fatah, the federally administered tribal areas, a sort of no man's land of territory along the border with Afghanistan and Iran, where the Taliban and other organizations provided the only real law. I work with most of the government-sponsored militias there, the Khyber Rifles, the Chitral Scouts, the Karam Militia. I see. And the department that is working to have me kicked out of the country? The order has come through normal channels, but I believe this action is being initiated by General Riaz Rihan, the head of Joint Intelligence Miscellaneous Division. JIM is responsible for foreign espionage operations. Embling knew what JIM was responsible for, but he allowed Aldakur to tell him. The Englishman's fertile brain raced through the possibilities of this encounter. He did not want to admit to anything, but he damn well wanted more intelligence about the situation. Major, I am at a loss here. I am not an English agent, but were I an English agent, I would hardly want to involve myself in the middle of the nasty infighting that goes on, as a matter of course, in the Pakistani intelligence community. If you have some quarrel with Joint Intelligence Miscellaneous, that's your problem, not Britain's. It is your problem,
because your nation has picked sides, and they have chosen poorly. Joint Intelligence Miscellaneous, Rian's directorate, has been given a great deal of support by the UK as well as the Americans. They have charmed and fooled your politicians, and I can prove it. If you can provide me the back-channel access to your leadership, then I will make my case, and your agency will learn a valuable lesson about trusting anyone in JIM. Major Aldarkul, please remember, I never said I worked with British intelligence.
No, you didn't.
I said that. Indeed. I am an old man, retired from the import-export field. Aldarkur smiled. Then I think you need to come out of retirement. Maybe export some intelligence out of Pakistan that might be useful to your nation. You could import some assistance from MI6 that might be useful to my country. I assure you that your nation has never had an asset in Pakistani intelligence as well placed as myself, with as much incentive to work for our joint interest as myself. And what about me? If I am given the boot from Pakistan, I won't be much help. I can delay your departure for months. Today was just the initial interview. I will drag my feet through every phase of the process after this. Embling nodded. Major, I just have to ask. If you are so sure your organization is rife with informants for General Rihan, how is it you are able to trust all these men working for you? Aldarkur smiled again. Before I was ISI, I was in SSG, Special Services Group. These men are also SSG. Commandos from Zarar Company, counter-terrorism operators, my former unit. And they are loyal to you? Aldarkur shrugged. They are loyal to the concept of not getting blown to bits by a roadside bomb. I share their allegiance to that concept myself. As do I, Major. Embling reached out and shook the Major's hand. So nice to find common ground with a new friend. It was a polite thing to say, but neither man in this room trusted the other so early in such a risky relationship. 2 hours later, Nigel Embling sat at home, drank tea at his desk, and drummed his fingers on a well-worn leather blotter. His morning had been interesting, to say the least. From a dead sleep to a pitch from a highly placed intelligence asset, it was enough to make his head spin. Houseboy Mahmoud, sporting a nasty purple and red gash on his head, brought his employer a plate with slices of sujika, a coconut flour, yogurt, and semolina-based pastry. He brought it home from the neighbor's house when Embling was returned by the SUVs from ISI. Embling took a sweet cake and bit into it, but he remained lost in thought. Thanks, lad. Why don't you go play football with your mates this afternoon? You've had a long day already. Thank you, Mr. Nigel. Thank you, my young friend, for being brave this morning. You and your mates will inherit this country someday soon, and I should think they will need a good and brave man like you will turn out to be. Mahmoud did not understand what his employer was talking about, but he did understand that he had the afternoon free to kick the soccer ball in the street with his friends. As his houseboy left him alone in his study, Embling ate his cakes and drank his tea, his mind filled with worry. Worry about the potential for him to be expelled, for the dangers of high-level infighting in the Pakistani Army's spy service, for the work that he would need to do to check out this Major Aldarkur to see if he was, in fact, who he said he was, and not affiliated with any of the naughtier elements roaming around. As worrisome as all this was, the chief concern of Embling's right now was supremely practical. It appeared to him as if he'd just recruited an agent to spy on behalf of a nation that he did not represent. He'd had no direct working relationship with London for years, though a few of the greybeards working at Legoland, the nickname of London's SIS headquarters on the Thames, gave him a call from time to time to check up on this or that. Once, the year before, they'd actually passed his name off to an American organization that he'd helped with a small matter here in Peshawar. The Yanks who'd arrived had been top-notch, some of the sharpest field operators he'd ever worked with. What were their names? Yes, John Clark and Ding Chavez. As Embling finished the last of his mid-morning snack and wiped his fingers clean with a napkin, he decided he could, if this Aldarkur chap checked out, run a very unusual version of the false flag. He could operate Aldarkur as an agent without Embling actually revealing to Aldarkur that he had no one, officially speaking, to pass his intelligence up the chain to. And then, when Embling had something important, something solid, Embling would find a customer for his product.
The big Englishman sipped the rest of his tea and smiled at the audacity of his new plan. It was ridiculous, really. But why on earth not? 18. Jack Ryan Sr. stepped over to a full-length mirror on the wall between two sets of lockers. Tonight's presidential debate at Cleveland's Case Western Reserve University was being held in the Emerson Physical Education Center to accommodate the huge crowd. It was also known as the Veal Center, and Ryan had no trouble picturing this venue hosting a basketball game. Around him on the walls of the locker room that had been converted into a dressing room for the presidential candidate, big Spartan silhouettes looked back at him. The adjacent bathroom set aside for Ryan's needs had a dozen showers. He'd needed none. He'd showered at the hotel. Tonight's debate was the second of three scheduled between himself and Keelty, and this was the one of the three Jack had insisted on. Just one moderator asking questions of the two men, seated at a table. Almost like a friendly conversation. It was to be less formal, less stiff. Keelty had objected at first, saying it was also less presidential. But Jack had held firm, and the backroom dealing of Jack's campaign manager, Arnie Van Dam, had won the day. The theme of tonight's debate would be foreign affairs, and Jack knew he had Keelty beat on the subject. The poll said so, so Arnie agreed too. But Jack was not relaxed. He looked into the mirror again and took another sip of water. He liked these all-too-brief moments of solitude. Kathy had just left the dressing room. Right now, she would be finding her seat in the front row. Her last words to him before leaving chimed in his ears as he looked at himself in the mirror. "Good luck, Jack. And don't forget your happy face." Along with Arnie and his speechwriter, Callie Weston, Kathy had been his closest confidant on this campaign. She did not get into policy discussions very often, unless the subject of health care came up. But she had watched her husband closely during his hundreds of television appearances, and she gave him her opinions on how he conveyed himself to the public. Kathy considered herself supremely qualified for the role. No one in the world knew Jack Ryan better than she did. She could look into his eyes or listen to the sound of his voice and know everything about his mood, his energy, even whether or not he'd snuck an afternoon cup of coffee that she did not permit when they were traveling together. Normally, Jack did great in front of a camera. He was natural, not stiff at all. He came off just like the man he was. A decent, intelligent guy who was, at the same time, strong-willed and motivated. But occasionally, Kathy saw things that she did not think helped him get his point across. Of particular concern to her was the fact that, in her opinion, whenever he talked about one of Keelty's policies or comments that he did not agree with, which was essentially everything that came out of Keelty's White House, Jack's face had a tendency to turn dark. Kathy had recently sat in bed with her husband, on one of the almost non-existent nights that found him taking a quick break at home from the campaign trail. For nearly an hour, she held the remote control for the flat-screen TV on the wall. That would have been hell enough for Jack Ryan, even if his mug was not on all the programs that she had recorded and flipped through. That was murderous for a guy who never liked seeing his face or hearing his voice on television. But Kathy was unrelenting. She used their TiVo, cycled from one press conference to the next, from lofty sit-down interviews with major network anchors all the way to impromptu exchanges with high school reporters while walking through shopping malls. In each clip she showed him, every time a Keelty policy was brought up, Jack Ryan's face changed. It wasn't a sneer, and for that Jack felt he should get a damn medal, as incensed as he was by literally every last decision of importance by the Keelty administration. But Kathy was right. Jack could not deny it. Whenever an interviewer brought up a Keelty policy, Jack's eyes narrowed slightly, his jaw tightened just perceptibly, and often his head shook back and forth just once, as if to say, no. Kathy had tracked back for a moment to show Jack at a barbecue in Fort Worth, with a paper plate of brisket and corn on the cob in one hand and an iced tea in the other. A C-SPAN camera crew following him picked up an exchange where a middle-aged woman mentioned Keelty's recent push for more regulation on the oil and gas industries. While the woman relayed the hardships her family was enduring, Jack's jaw tightened and he shook his head. There was empathy relayed in his body language, but only after his initial recoil of anger. His first reaction, that first flash of rage, locked into a still frame when Kathy pressed the pause button, was unmistakable. As they sat in bed together, Jack Ryan tried to lighten the moment.
I think I deserve partial credit on that one for not tossing up the baked beans I'd just eaten. I mean, we were talking about increasing red tape and bureaucracy on business in this economy.
Kathy smiled, shook her head.
Partial credit isn't going to get you the highest office in the land this time, Jack. You are winning, but you haven't won yet.